Rush. This is SRN News.
San Diego's Intelligent Talk, 1170 KCBQ.
The Bob Siegel Show is made possible in part by ProBuild, Primetime Advertising Corporation, Web Studio, W&S Electric Incorporated, and the law offices of Matthew Simone. The views and opinions are solely those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent KPRZ or its sponsors. It's time now for the Bob Siegel Show, a religious open forum where all questions are welcome. And now, here's your host, Christian apologist, Bob Siegel.
And this is Bob Siegel. So, you'd like to believe in God, but you wonder how anyone can believe in a God who does miracles. And coming out of the Christmas season, you find yourself especially astonished by those who claim to believe that a virgin can bear a child and those who celebrated that idea all December. For this reason, even many who call themselves Christians deny the supernatural elements of the Bible. Instead, they try to believe in the Jesus who was not born of a virgin, and many of my Jewish friends who do believe God is sending a Messiah of some kind someday reject Jesus as this particular Messiah, among other reasons, because of the alleged virgin birth. Well, stick around, because today I'm going to show you how we cannot have it both ways. The Messiah, whoever he is, must be born of a virgin. And I'm not just talking about the fact that there's a prophecy in Isaiah that says he's going to be born of a virgin. I'm saying that God had to give the prophecy because for some other reason, the Messiah had to be born of a virgin. If he is not born of a virgin, he cannot make his appearance at all. So it may as well be Jesus, or at least Jesus cannot be dismissed as a candidate due to virgin birth narratives in the Gospels. Welcome to the program that includes those two forbidden dinner table topics, religion and politics. Indeed, this is the very theme of the Bob Siegel Show, Christianity and its relationship to politics and pop culture. And today we begin the fifth year of our program. It's good to be back with you. We ran repeat broadcasts for the past 2 weeks, and much has happened in the news during my absence, even though I have tried and tried really hard to pay less attention over my Christmas break. Now, I should say, although my Christmas vacation is over, my celebration of Christmas is not. I'm very eccentric that way. The older I get, the more I find Christmas to be a soothing time of the year. And I figure if we're going to have cold weather, we may as well just continue to have Christmas right along with it. For this reason, I do not rip off my lights or turn off my Mannheim steamroller music on December the 26th. As a matter of fact, I celebrate Christmas from November to March. Now, don't worry. That doesn't mean I'm going to burden you with that. Yes, I am going to play Christmas bumper music today just one more time, but the regular music will return next week. Still, I do have just a few more things to say about Christmas on today's show, not only regarding the virgin birth topic, but the celebration itself. Many Christian pastors, believe it or not, tell their congregations it's a sin to celebrate Christmas. Yes, you heard me correctly. Christian pastors saying it's a sin to celebrate Christmas. And so as Christmas season winds down, since the topic is still on your mind, at least a little bit, you might find this to be an interesting discussion. And we'll begin that discussion after the latest news, because much as we may hate the news just won't go away. As always, I'm also interested in hearing what you have to say. I have no guest today. It's just you and me. So feel free to call in. Give me a call, 1-888-344-1170. That's 1-888-344-1170. We also take email questions and comments, questions at bobsiegel.net. That's questions at bobsiegel, S-I-E-G-E-L.net. And this is from John, responding to some of my Christmas musings. Merry Christmas, Bob. And a happy new year to you. I am glad you are having a season of reflection and meditation with God. I am sure you are aware of the news from Israel. I am looking forward to your perspective on those events with your recent travel to the Blessed Land. Well, thank you for the kind words, John, and thanks also for your interest in my opinion of Israel. Actually, let's talk about Israel right now. Notice how Muslims all over the world and their symbiotic, politically correct allies are protesting Israel's excessive use of force in retaliating for the Gaza missiles. Now, forgive me, but one just has to ask, how many Muslim demonstrations did we see these past 3 years, over 3 years, when Hamas sent missiles into Israel toward Israel's population, men, women, and children, day after day after day, as a reward to Israel for giving back the occupied land to the Palestinians? Our world has lost sight of a simple, fundamental fact. The reason Muslim countries do not want Israel in the Middle East is because Israel is not a Muslim country. Period. Evidence for this painful but accurate truth is readily available to anyone. At least anyone who wants to study history, not historical revision, not the garbage they're teaching at universities days, real history or just current events. Just go to the current events. But if the peaceful practices of countries today like Iran, Saudi Arabia, and Syria say nothing to you, just read the Quran itself and the numerous commands to convert or kill all non-Muslims. It's found in chapter 9 or Surah 9. Now, stop right there. Before you call in, before you tell me I'm taking the Quran out of context, its author, claiming to hear from Allah, interpreted his own repeated violent words just exactly that way. Under Muhammad, Islam came into the world by force. Today, many moderate Muslim spokespeople, when confronted with the jihad commands and the history of Islam, defend their religion in a manner that goes more or less like this. Honestly, Islam is really a religion of peace. We can see where it may not look that way. Today, it's fashionable for people to defend Islam. It's become a politically correct religion. And liberals love to defend this religion, which, if it conquered our country, would kill the liberals before it killed anyone else. Today, it is also fashionable for people on the left to say, oh, I'm not anti-Semitic, but I am anti-Zionist. It's not politically correct to be anti-Semitic, so I'm not anti-Semitic. I got nothing against Jews. I got a lot against Zionism. Quick review. A Zionist is simply one who believes the Jews have a right to their own national homeland. Maybe it's time to remind everyone what Martin Luther King, beloved by the left and the right alike, Martin Luther King, what he said about Zionism. Martin Luther King said, anti-Zionism is inherently anti-Semitic and ever will be so. I'm reading from the selections of the writings of Dr. Martin Luther King. Now, I'm aware that many who speak against Israel do so out of ignorance, perhaps sincere ignorance, because they are victims of the historical revisionist teachers. But then, many anti-Semites are sincerely ignorant as well. Inasmuch as missiles have been fired into Israel almost every day for the past 3 years as a result of Israel trading land for peace, why exactly should Israel trust the Palestinians and give back any more land? There can be no two-state solution. Somebody had to say it. It may as well be me. There can be no two-state solution. And when I was in Israel, I said this to Israelis who desperately want peace and hope there can be a two-state solution. There can be none. Simply put, the Palestinians do not want two states. They want one state, their state. When they speak of occupied territory, they do not mean the West Bank. They do not mean the Golan Heights. They do not mean the formerly occupied Gaza Strip. They mean all of Israel. They teach their children that Israel should be exterminated. Now, how are you going to make peace with a people like that? Unfortunately, none of these facts will stop the worldwide condemnation for Israel's aggressive response to the terrorist organization Hamas, elected by the peace-loving Palestinians. And guess what the new Obama administration is planning on doing? They are planning on forcing Israel to return to the pre-1967 borders, which are indefensible borders. Speaking of Obama, unlike the foes of George Bush when Bush first got elected, I and other conservatives will give Obama a break. We will give Obama a chance. And yes, we will call him our president. For 8 years, people on the left refused to call Bush their president. Obama is my president. I'm not happy about it, but he's my president. I will give him a chance. Still, the concerns people had before Obama took office have not magically vanished into thin air. Now, as a token of my sincerity, I do give him credit for standing by Rick Warren despite many cries from the left. But, folks, let's not lose our heads over this. There seems to be this big sigh of relief from so many conservatives giving into the idea that Obama is going to govern from the center. From the center? I guess we'll see. That would be wonderful. But when Hillary Clinton's selection as Secretary of State is listed as an example of a centrist on Obama's cabinet, I have to start wondering if people know their center from their left from their right anymore. Former Republican Speaker of the House Newt Gingrich recently said, "The American people do not want to hear criticism of Obama right now." How shall I put this? In as much as I am one of the American people, Newt, go ahead. Try me. Well, I needed to blog about a few of these events over Christmas break. It was unavoidable. Still, as much as possible, I spent my vacation thinking mostly about Christmas itself. We are used to atheists speaking against Christmas, not only during the month of December, but all year round. I remember one formal debate where my opponent went out of his way to mention that Christmas was originally a pagan holiday, the Roman festival of Saturnalia transformed into a Christian feast many years later after Emperor Constantine made Christianity an official religion of Rome. I guess the idea was for me to be incredibly surprised and fall over on the stage in the face of this revelation. Instead, I quietly, gently asked my opponent what holidays had to do with our discussion about the accuracy of the Bible. The Bible, after all, says nothing about Christmas one way or the other. Now, that may have curtailed a debate rabbit trail, but it also leads to a related subject. Many Christian pastors also speak against celebrating Christmas, and ironically, they do for the exact same reason as the atheists. Christmas is a converted holiday. Allow me to pose a simple question. If Christianity is about converting souls and Christianity is also about converting nations, what exactly is wrong with converting holidays? Yes, sweet Virginia, it is true. Christmas was once Saturnalia. With all due respect to both atheist and pastor friends, so what? In Paul's letter to the Corinthians, he addressed a similar concern. It was another pagan religious practice being morphed into an alternative social function. This time, the situation was meat. In ancient Greece, leftover meat from animal sacrifices was placed on the open market. It was like buying it at Vons, but it had been sacrificed to the gods at first. This raised quite a discussion in the church, and we'll talk about that discussion when we return to the Bob Siegel Show. So, you think you can run your new business without a website? Hello, McFly. How are they going to discover your business? The phone book? Do people even use that thing anymore? Or maybe you just leave your business card in restaurants next to the generous tip, but you won't be able to afford that generosity much longer if you don't start using the internet. I do understand. If you're anything like me, you entered the computer age kicking and screaming. After all, I'm the artist type. That's a fancy way of saying that the only time I fix a computer myself is by rebooting or remembering to plug it in. But I'll tell you, even though I'm more into the arts than the sciences, I use my computer constantly, all day long, in fact, and I couldn't even imagine getting by without my website. Let me tell you how to build a website of your own simply and easily without the cost and trouble of a designer. The name is Web Studio. I don't see you writing this down. Web Studio. Web Studio is a website design software. It enables you to create your own pages in minutes without knowing HTML. All you do is use your mouse to drag and drop images and text. Then it saves the pages for you on the internet. Sounds simple? The program includes 14 different galleries that contain graphics, sounds, and anything else you need. For more information about Web Studio, go to webstudio.com. And don't worry, you can still use that sharp-looking business card. Just print your website on it. And welcome. Welcome to the 21st century. Did you know we've been to the moon?
Hey, this is Lori K. Lewis, a frequent co-host on The Bob Siegel Show, Talk Radio 1170 on KCBQ. If you have questions or comments during this radio broadcast, please call Bob at this toll-free number, 1-888-344-1170. Again, the number is 1-888-344-1170. We'd like to hear what you have to say.
Welcome back to the Bob Siegel Show on Intelligent Talk 1170 KCBQ. There are pastors who actually have found something to agree with atheists about. You never thought you'd live to see the day, but they both condemn Christmas. Not all pastors, but some pastors. And I heard one talking about this on television over the Christmas holiday. And so since the Bible doesn't say anything about Christmas one way or the other, but the Bible does talk about holidays and feasts, I'm trying to show you how Paul would have dealt with a situation like this. How would Paul have dealt with somebody saying to him, should Christmas be celebrated by Christians when it was originally a pagan Roman feast? Well, speaking of pagan feasts, as we mentioned right before the break, in ancient Greece, every time meat was sacrificed to some Greek deity, the rest of the meat, the one part not used by the priest, was sold on the open marketplace. One honestly could not purchase meat in those days or eat meat without knowing that the pound of protein had first been used in the worship of some Greek deity. Many Christians worshiped these very idols in their BC years, and they were feeling guilty now about enjoying such meat once again out of fear, and it was understandable fear that they were returning to idol worship, the very practice they had recently renounced. And this caused a rift in the church. Some said, it's just meat for crying out loud, chill out. Others found the edibility of animals to be sinful. Well, Paul was asked to comment on this situation, and he gave two responses. First, he reminded people that meat by itself was something neutral. If it had been used in the sacrifice of some fake god, some god that you know doesn't really exist, so be it. As long as a Christian renounced his former religion and consumed the food for no reason other than the fact that he might like meat, no harm was being done. On the other hand, and Paul said this very carefully, he warned the Corinthians never to encourage the violation of one's conscience. In other words, for the record, it was not a sin to eat meat, but if some people thought it was, why tempt your friends to do what they feel is a sin? On Judgment Day, God will judge their hearts and motives, not their knowledge about freedom versus legalism. Now, I would like to offer that exact same advice for my fellow Christians today. If you personally choose not to celebrate Christmas, I respect your choice. But before judging others who view this time of the year as a beautiful, meaningful celebration of Christ, I urge you to take a second look at 1 Corinthians. Hey, that is kind of a ring. Bob's second look at 1 Corinthians. Okay, 1-888-344-1170 if you'd like to weigh in on any of this. Or questions at bobsiegel.net. And this is Mike from Champaign, Illinois. He says, good stuff as always. I especially resonate with you on Christmas. I love both aspects of the holidays. Thank you, Mike. Now, here's another question that I get frequently, and it's going to get us into this virgin birth thing. Question, Bob, aren't the genealogies of Jesus in Matthew and Luke a contradiction? They give different names for Joseph's father, and after that, the rest of the lineage is also listed differently. Okay, now on a first glance, this does indeed look like a Bible contradiction. I'm reading from Matthew 1:16 in the middle of a huge genealogy. It says, and Jacob, the father of Joseph, the husband of Mary, of whom was born Jesus, who was called Christ. Now, in Luke, they give a different genealogy, but Joseph's name appears in that as well, Luke 3:23-24. Now, Jesus himself was about 30 years old when he began his ministry. He was the son, so it was thought, of Joseph, the son of Heli. So Luke says that Joseph was the son of Heli. Matthew says that Joseph was the son of Jacob. Matthew and Luke both list Jesus as the son of Joseph, but Luke and Matthew both say that obviously Joseph is the adoptive father of Jesus, and he's only related by blood to Mary. Now, in all probability, Luke is giving us Mary's genealogy rather than Joseph's. And you're thinking to yourself, but Bob, it doesn't say that. Luke also calls Jesus the son of Joseph. Yes, he does. But you need to understand what the words of the Bible meant to the original audience is what it means to us. In ancient Judaism, if a man had no son, his son-in-law was viewed as his son. And this same man received his inheritance. For that reason, Heli might actually be the father of Mary, and it would have been considered just as proper to call him the father of Joseph, especially in a genealogy. Now, evidence for this plausible theory can be found by turning to the pages of the Jerusalem Talmud. What is the Jerusalem Talmud? An ancient rabbinical commentary that tends to paint Jesus and his mother Mary by the Jews with derogatory strokes. And hold on to your seats. In the Talmud, Mary is actually referred to as the daughter of Heli. Isn't that interesting? And now you're wondering, well, why would God have given us both genealogies? Why do we need to see Jesus' genealogy through his mother and his father? That is an excellent question, and I have a fascinating answer for you. Although not his blood father, Joseph was Jesus' legal father, and Joseph was blood related to King David. David, of course, had many wives, and therefore David had many children. As a result, not all of David's offspring were in David's kingly line, but the Messiah had to be both a blood descendant of King David and legal heir through the kingly line, according to Jeremiah 23. Now then, Mary was also related to King David, but not through Solomon, which would have been the kingly line. These two genealogies tell us something very interesting about Jesus' credentials. Jesus was a literal blood descendant of King David, which he needed to be, but not through the kingly line, and that was due to his mother Mary. But he was also a legal descendant of David through the kingly line due to his adoptive father, Joseph. Why is all of this relevant? Because the last king of Judah, prior to the destruction of the nation at the hands of the Babylonians, was a man named King Jehoiachin. Jehoiachin did not walk with God, and as a result, God predicted through the prophet Jeremiah that none of Jehoiachin's descendants would ever sit on the throne of Israel, at least not any throne recognized by God. Jeremiah 22:28-30. I'm reading from the New International Version. And this is God speaking through Jeremiah about Jehoiachin. Is this man, Jehoiachin, a despised broken pot, an object no one wants? Why will he and his children be hurled out, cast into a land they do not know? Oh, land, 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 hear the word of the Lord. This is what the Lord says. Record this man as if childless, a man who will not prosper in his lifetime, for none of his offspring will prosper. None will sit on the throne of David or rule anymore in Judah. Now, that's interesting. The last king of Judah cannot have any children sit on the throne. Well, then how can the Messiah be related to the last king of Judah? God solves this paradox, and he solves it when we return. This is Bob Siegel. They say a man's home is his castle. So when it comes to the wiring of your house, you don't want to mess around with some unknown electrician. Instead, do what I did. Call W&S Electric Incorporated. W&S specializes in both contracting and repair. From troubleshooting to remodeling to circuit breakers and fuses, W&S takes a skilled but personal interest in your home at affordable rates. I know the owner, Wayne Klingenhofer, personally, and I can testify firsthand to his integrity. Call 619-447-8785. That's 447-8785 for W&S Electric Incorporated. License number 480539, W&S Electric. This is Bob Siegel inviting you to tune in for the Rick Amato Show four nights a week here on 1170 KCBQ. Rick stays on top of the issues local and national. He also does some of the most stimulating interviews you've ever heard. That's the Rick Amato Show Monday through Thursdays from 9 p.m. to 11 p.m. here on Intelligent Talk 1170 KCBQ. You can also find Rick on AmatoTalk.com.
We now return to the Bob Siegel Show.
Thank you. Welcome back to the Bob Siegel Show on Intelligent Talk 1170 KCBQ. We're talking about why the Messiah had to be born of a virgin. And of course, everybody's familiar that in Isaiah 7, there's a prediction that the Messiah will be born of a virgin. However, we're going even beyond that. Why did God even need to predict it? Why did God even need to make it so? Because it solved a problem. Before we went to the break, I mentioned that Jesus, through his adoptive father Joseph, was a legal descendant of King David. Jesus, through his real mother Mary, was a physical descendant of King David. Joseph went to King David through the kingly line, through Solomon. But David had many wives and many concubines and many children. Mary went back to King David, but not through the kingly line. So Jesus being connected to King David through Mary satisfies half of the requirements, the requirement to be a blood descendant of David. But it doesn't satisfy the other half, that it's not just a blood descendant. He's got to go back to the kingly line. But then we had this problem. We can go to the book of Jeremiah, and the last king of Israel, or they called it the nation of Judah at that time, King Jehoiachin, was an evil king, didn't obey God. That's why God allowed the Babylonians to conquer them. And God said, none of Jehoiachin's children will ever sit upon a throne that God himself recognizes as a legitimate throne. Well, if that's the case, and Jehoiachin is related to King David and through the kingly line, then if Jesus was born to David through the kingly line, that would mean that Jehoiachin would also be in his family ancestry, which means the King Jehoiachin curse would hit Jesus. See the paradox? If the Messiah must be related to King David and legal heir through the kingly line, then he must also be related to King Jehoiachin. But the Jehoiachin curse prohibits further kings of Israel, for none of Jehoiachin's children can sit on a throne recognized as a legitimate throne by God. Folks, the virgin birth solves our paradox. Jesus is a literal blood descendant of King David, but not through the kingly line. For that reason, the Jehoiachin curse does not affect him. Still, the Messiah had to be legal heir to the throne, and Jesus is legally related to David through Joseph. But since it is legal only and not a blood relation, the Jehoiachin curse does not touch him. People, the Bible's been around a long time. Often what seems like a contradiction to us is worked out by a wonderful God who loves to startle and amaze his followers. Messianic prophecy has been fulfilled through the miracle of the virgin birth. That seems to be the reason for the two different genealogies, and that is one of the reasons why the Messiah needed to be born of a virgin. 1-888-344-1170 or questions@bobsiegel.net. Regarding the blog version of this whole virgin birth thing, Allison writes, well done. I know why Jesus could not have Adam's blood, but had not thought about his lineage in a while. Thank you for the reminder. I trust you had a blessed Christmas, Bob. Well, thank you, Allison. And this is from our friend Peter in Maine. Peter had converted to evangelical Christianity and still calls himself one by a thin thread, if I'm representing him correctly. But he struggles with a lot of doubt. He's called in, he's written emails, we've read some before, and he's written a long email here, and we're going to unpack this a little bit at a time, because he makes some very interesting points, and I know that there are many Peters out there that are listening. So Peter in Maine writes, hello, Bob. I hope you are well on this Christmas Eve. Much of my time spent pondering in these last few months has been more political than spiritual, as is probably true for many of us. I know a lot of my emails and comments to you have centered on politics and the election. However, I found myself this Christmas Eve with a one-hour commute to my job, exploring more spiritual ideas in my mind. As you know, I have spent a lot of years contemplating the nature, origin, and meaning of life, the possibility of God, etc., but also have a very solidly scientific upbringing and perspective. This morning, I asked myself, how do we try to explain life as we see it? In the scientific and mathematical world, we formulate a theory, and we see how well the predictions of the theory fit or fail to fit the available data. In many ways, theology, cosmology, and other metaphysical inquiries are no different. In some ways, and I intend no disrespect or insult, I see religious apology as an effort to fit religious doctrine into our observed reality, which sometimes seems, at least to me, to be an effort to force the proverbial square peg into a round table. Well, boy, he writes well. Let me define a couple of these terms. If you're new to our program, he says Christian apology. Okay, what he means by that is I am a Christian apologist. That's what I do. That's my career. This radio show is one of many things I do. I also do lectures and debates at universities, and I'm introduced as a Christian apologist. What is a Christian apologist? It's a kind of Christian evangelist, but not the kind that just gets up there and says, you know, you feel something in your gut, come forward. Although I do believe and agree that unless the Holy Spirit does a work in somebody's heart, and that's where the rubber meets the road, they can't give their lives to Christ. Many times, especially when I'm at the university, but in other places, people ask very intelligent questions about Christianity. How can a loving God allow suffering? How do we know the Bible manuscripts are accurate? How do we know Christ rose from the dead? Were there any eyewitnesses? Moral questions, intelligent questions. Well, a Christian apologist is one who reasons it out with people, not one who tells people to accept Christianity by blind faith. So what he's saying is, and he had read my book about apologetics, and he's saying that he thinks Christian apologists, like me, but he means no disrespect, tend to try to fit a square peg in a round hole, that we're ignoring certain problems. Now, I don't agree with that, but he's saying that very sincerely. So we're going to elaborate then. He says this applies more to moral or logical apologetics than to historical apologetics. For example, apologetics attempts to explain things like the perceived universality of internal moral laws, commonly called conscience, or problematic aspects of belief, such as divine hiddenness or the existence of evil. This is where I think the square peg analogy is the most appropriate. Okay, now let me define some terms here. He's referring to a whole chapter in my book. I wrote a book called I'd Like to Believe in Jesus, But... And the subtitle was The Harder, Less Frequently Discussed Questions. And in chapter 3 of my book, I give what's called the moral case for the existence of God. And the Reader's Digest version of this case is that if we claim there's such a thing as right and wrong, then to be consistent with that belief, we have to say that some kind of God exists. Not necessarily the God of the Bible, even though we could bring in other historical evidence to verify that, but some kind of God. Because if there is no God, then life is an accident. If we're here by accident, then nobody has any moral authority over anybody. In other words, if one does not accept a God, one must, to be consistent, become a moral relativist. But I've never met a true, consistent moral relativist. And I only know of one consistent moral relativist in history. That's Friedrich Nietzsche, who came out and admitted. He said, if God is dead, man is dead. Well, we'll talk more about Nietzsche and more about my concerns from Peter in Maine when we return to the Bob Siegel Show.
How many times have you heard the phrase, they're all the same, applied to local contractors? It is unfortunate that a few can tarnish the reputations of many, but it sure is nice when you find a contractor with godly principles. But what if they only do floors or only the painting? What if you want to build a whole new home? Or you want someone to fully complete your remodel or tenant improvements? You need ProBuilt. Serving San Diego since 1987, residential and commercial, quality work, completed on time. Local Christian businessman and president of ProBuilt, Jim Bell, said, when people pay you to do a job, they simply want you to do the job. They expect quality work, and they expect it to be done on time. We do that at ProBuilt. For references and dozens of pictures of both residential and commercial work, visit our website, ProBuiltInc.com. That's ProBuiltInc.com. Or call our El Cajon office at 619-593-2965. We're fully bonded and insured. California State License Number 567925. ProBuilt.
I'd like to remind all of my listeners that the Bob Siegel Show has a sister program on our sister station, KPRZ 1210 on the dial. Every Sunday morning from 9 o'clock to 9:30, you can hear City Voice. On this provocative program, my good friend George Runyon interviews a different local Christian ministry every week. You can listen to the show while driving to church, and don't be surprised, you may find it so interesting that you'll stay in the parking lot continuing to listen and skipping those Sunday school donuts. That's City Voice with George Runyon, every Sunday morning from 9 o'clock to 9:30 on our sister station, KPRZ 1210. But right now, you're listening to KCBQ 1170. Welcome back to the Bob Siegel Show. Before we went to the break, I was reading a letter, an email from Peter in Maine, a person that I've had very respectful dialogues, a true sincere skeptic. I meet skeptics that are not sincere. I meet skeptics who are hoping they cannot be talked into Christianity. Peter's hoping he can be talked into it. I can speak for his heart to the degree that I have encountered his true motives. But he's arguing against what we call the moral argument for the existence of God. Now, here's the way the moral argument works. If God doesn't exist, then you have to think of the implications. See, a lot of times I go out to a college campus and I put up a big sign that says atheism is inconsistent. And people come up to me and they say, I'm an atheist and I'm very consistent. I don't go to church. I think all Christians are stupid. I don't read the Bible. And I go, well, yeah, I know you think you're being consistent, but you don't think about the implications of God's non-existence. They say, well, what do you mean by that? I said, well, if God doesn't exist, then all kinds of other things have to be true. For example, if you're only here by randomness and chance and there's no creator, there's no order, there's no design, because you can't have a design without a designer, then you're just a shot in the dark. You're here by accident. Your life is an accident. Everybody's life is an accident. Do you live your life as though you're a mere accident? Well, nobody lives their life as if they are a mere accident. In fact, I've talked to atheists who get very insulted that they call it accidental. I go, well, okay, well, if God didn't create you with a purpose, then you're an accident. I mean, call it whatever you want. Call it randomness if you want, but that's how we define an accident. Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't do that on purpose. It was an accident. If God doesn't exist, there's no purpose to your life. There's no meaning to your life. You're an accident. Now, nobody lives that way. Because to live that way, we would have to say that there's no such thing as right and wrong. If I'm here by accident and you're here by accident, and we have a difference of opinion, then your opinion's no more valid than mine. So supposing I was in school, college campus, and I pulled a pencil out of somebody's hand. He could say, excuse me, that's my pencil. And I could say, well, it was your pencil, now it's mine. And if I'm bigger than you, that's not going to be a problem. He could say, well, that's stealing. I could say, yeah, that's right, that's stealing. And then he could say, well, stealing's wrong. And I'd say, well, who says so? And he could say, well, the law says so. And then I go, well, that may be, but that doesn't mean it's wrong. That just means we have a law that says not to do it. And I don't think you're going to sue me over a 5-cent pencil anyway. So you're going to have to give me a better reason. We've had bad laws anyway. In Nazi Germany, they had laws that Jews couldn't go to the park. So just because something's the law doesn't mean it's right. Give me a reason why stealing is wrong. Well, because you should respect my rights. Well, why should I respect your rights? Because I have value and dignity as a human being. Who says so? There's no God. I'm an accident. You're an accident. We're both a lot of slop that accidentally evolved to a higher order. In fact, even terms like higher and lower are relative. So as one accident to another, I say there's nothing wrong with stealing this pencil. In fact, to get more graphic, forgive me, somebody could break into your house, murder one of your loved ones in front of your eyes, and what are you going to do? Say, well, as a moral relativist, I can't dogmatically claim that what you did was wrong. In my opinion, you shouldn't have done it, but who am I to judge? You see, nobody does that. Oh, yeah, they experiment with this stuff in a philosophy class. You go into a philosophy class at the university, and your teacher says it's all relative. There's no such thing as right. There's no such thing as wrong. Good and evil are antiquated notions. And then you walk outside. Somebody ripped off your bicycle. What do? You cry out in moral indignation. He should not have done that. You see, what's cute in the classroom and clever in the classroom doesn't always fit out in the street. Out in the street where we live is where we see how we really feel about things. In fact, one of the greatest objections to Christianity, one of the greatest objections is religious hypocrisy. People say to me, I'm tired of you Christians always judging people. And you know, the moment a person says it's wrong to judge, they've just judged you. They've just said it's wrong to judge. So they do believe in right and wrong. And then they say they have a problem with religious hypocrisy. And I love to ask them this question. I say, are you morally outraged by religious hypocrisy? They say, yes. I say, well, how can that be if there's no such thing as morality? That's called the moral argument for the existence of God. Does it prove God exists? No. It gives rational evidence that God exists, because in the realm of philosophy and rational thought, if one can't live consistently with their philosophy or theory or worldview, their worldview becomes very suspicious. It is more consistent to live as though there is a God than to live as though there is not a God. Now, Peter's very aware of this argument because he's heard me give it on my program and he's read it in my book and he's arguing against it. So he says, on my drive to work, I contemplated my own favorite theory, which is by no means a firm belief, that of deism. Okay, let me stop and give another, not disclaimer, but another definition here, because Peter's using terms that those who love to argue theology and philosophy are aware of. What is deism? Deism is a belief that there is some kind of God, but not a personal God. Not a God who involves himself in our lives. It's a God who kind of wound up the universe like a great big watch, and then he sits back and watches with dispassionate lack of interest. Thomas Jefferson was a deist. He had no problem with Christianity morally. He certainly was not of the opinion that church and state needed to be separated. That's such a myth. He had no problem with Christianity, but he was not a Christian. He was a deist. Ben Franklin was a deist. Most of our other forefathers were Christians, contrary to what you popularly believe. But a deist is one who says, look, you can't have a watch without a watchmaker. The universe does look like it's been designed, but because they see so much evil in the world, they have a hard time believing that God is really involving himself in human affairs. And that's what Peter's trying to say. He says, I have long believed that the physical universe and the existence of life were the strongest arguments for God, at least for the supreme being creator aspect of God. As a computer scientist, I understand very well the absurdity and astronomical probabilities involved in the theory that life could arise from the random collision of molecules in a primordial soup. Well said, Peter. Peter continues, I often think of the idea of a million monkeys typing on a million typewriters trying to produce the first 10 words of the Bible or a line from Shakespeare through random chance. Even a relatively simple phrase like have a nice day, 12 letters, not counting the spaces, would involve a probability of one chance in 26 to the 12th power or about one chance in 95,000 trillion. Well, I'm glad you did the math, Peter, because I sure don't feel like doing that. On the origin of life, Peter continues to say, deism and monotheistic religions, Christianity, Judaism, and Islam, all score essentially the same. The problem of origins is solved, ignoring for now the question of the origin of God himself or itself. It is where the various explanations or theories try to explain the nature of that God or being that things diverge, in my opinion. This is where I see monotheism and the idea of a personal, anthropomorphic God as moral lawgiver and judge starting to break down, and where apologetics starts to jump through hoops in the attempt to fit the square peg of God into the round hole of our observed universe. So he's saying, I believe in a deist kind of God, but there's no evidence that God takes interest in our life. I could not disagree more, and I'll tell you why I disagree when we return to the Bob Siegel Show. Looking to build your own website without a lot of cost and trouble? Hi, I'm Bob Siegel, here to tell you about Web Studio. Web Studio allows people to create their own websites simply and easily without knowing HTML. With Web Studio, you avoid the learning curve of front page and the expense of a web designer. Web Studio has 14 different galleries that contain graphics, sounds, and everything else you need. For more information about Web Studio, go to webstudio.com. This is Bob Siegel inviting you to tune in for the Rick Amato Show four nights a week here on 1170 KCBQ. Rick stays on top of the issues, local and national. He also does some of the most stimulating interviews you've ever heard. If you don't think you need such news talk and commentary, just try this quick pop quiz. Does Kevin Billings serve in the California State Senate or the United States Senate? Time's up! You were wrong no matter how you answered, because there is no Kevin Billings, and you might have known that if you'd been listening to the Rick Amato Show. I'm telling you, folks, this is the best talk show in San Diego. Oh, wait, I forgot about my own program. I'm telling you, folks, this is one of the two best talk shows in San Diego and the only live local evening talk show in San Diego. That's the Rick Amato Show, Monday through Thursdays from 9 p.m. to 11 p.m. here on Intelligent Talk 1170 KCBQ. You can also find Rick on AmatoTalk.com.
We now return to the Bob Siegel Show.
Welcome back to our program. A deist is somebody who believes in God but doesn't believe this God takes an interest in the affairs of human beings. My friend Peter, who is an evangelical Christian but struggling with doubts, sincerely struggling, and talking very respectfully through his letter, says he's experimenting in his mind now with deism. Deism, in contrast to evangelicalism, he says, makes no assertions in terms of morality, justice, or why there is evil, or why God seems to be hidden, etc., etc. In fact, Peter goes on to say, I believe deism fits our observed reality better in these respects. Consider this, a foundational idea of Christianity, and also a significant part of your own apologetics, is the notion that the golden rule constitutes a supreme moral imperative. Okay, now what is the golden rule? Jesus' words in the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 5-7, say, as you would have people treat you, treat them. And in other words, this is the one standard of God, that we're to love God, we're to love our fellow man. So we commonly call this the golden rule. And by the way, when I get into the debates with atheists, they say, I don't need to be a Christian to follow the golden rule. And I go, that's my whole point. You do follow the golden rule. Now, we all have sin nature, so none of us follow it well, neither myself nor the atheist. But he ascribes to the golden rule. And why? If there is no God, there would be no golden rule, unless it's a golden rule we made up. Did we just make up the idea that we should be unselfish? Well, if we made it up, then as one accident to another, I don't have to go along with it. So my point that everybody, regardless of their culture and their upbringing, knows in their conscience that there's a golden rule, that is an argument that that rule had to come from somewhere. See, laws don't float around in the universe like alphabet soup. There can be no such thing as morality or a moral code apart from personality, because what is morality? It is a running commentary on the way human beings interact with ourselves. So through the conscience, we know God's law, and it's one law. Treat people as you would want them to treat you. All the other laws in the Bible fall under that. Look at the Ten Commandments. If you're going to treat your neighbor the way you want to be treated, well, you wouldn't want your neighbor sleeping with your wife, so you don't sleep with his. You wouldn't want your neighbor stealing from you, so you don't steal from him. Pardon me for being so obvious. You wouldn't want your neighbor to murder you, so you don't murder him. You wouldn't want your neighbor coveting your goods, you don't covet his. Okay, so Peter's very aware that I use this golden rule argument that, well, where did this rule come from if there's no God? He says it constitutes a supreme moral imperative that all people should treat others as they would like to be treated. But, Peter says, suppose for a moment that God's supreme moral law was something else. Perhaps the idea that freedom is the highest imperative. Okay, Peter, we can suppose that freedom is the highest imperative, but I want to respond right now and say, our conscience does not tell us that freedom is the highest imperative. Our desires tell us that freedom is the highest imperative. Our conscience tells us it would be wrong to rob somebody else of their freedom. In other words, I can experience freedom, but when I do it at the expense of somebody else's freedom, my conscience kicks in. So even if you wanted to say that freedom was an imperative, it cannot be one without the conscience, because for me to say I want to be free, but I don't care if anybody else is free, would violate my own conscience. Now, Peter, if I was going to make up my own conscience and make up my own rules, why wouldn't I make up rules I can follow a little better? The very fact that human beings have this conscience, which tells them to be unselfish, but human beings live so doggone selfishly, says something. Since the beginning of time, human beings have had war, crime, bloodshed, racism, murder, rape. I mean, our technology has changed, but our morality is as barbaric as ever. In fact, a lot of times people try to use that as an argument against this idea. Well, human beings don't live by the golden rule. I go, that's right, they don't. So there's no evidence in the world that we would have invented this rule that we don't live by very well. Seems like it came from a source outside of ourselves. Seems like somebody or someone programmed that right into our DNA and integrated it with our personality. Anyway, Peter continues, it's such a long letter that I need to comment on it bit by bit. Otherwise, by the time I comment, you'll forget what he said. So he says, perhaps the idea of freedom is the highest imperative. If this were the case, two major problems of the world's monotheistic religions, the existence of evil and the hiddenness of God, dissolve. If freedom is the imperative, then evil is simply a necessary side effect or result of that freedom. Yeah, but Peter, the minute you call evil evil, you're saying that it's wrong. What convinces you that evil is evil? If there's no God, there is no evil, and there is no good. Now, some people today try to say there is no evil, but everybody believes in evil. Let me say it again. Everybody believes in evil. The next time one of your smug friends tells you they don't believe in evil, ask them if they believe in good. And they're going to say, of course I believe in good. Then say, define good. Well, good is treating people the way you want them to treat you. Okay, so what is not treating people the way you want to be treated? Well, they're not going to want to use the word evil because they're not going to want to lose the argument. So they'll say, well, that's minus good, less than good. In other words, goodness can't exist without it being relative to something. Don't we know that when we read in the newspapers that some poor person got murdered, that the person who did that should not have done that? Don't we know that that's evil? But what Peter's saying is if the only imperative we have from God is freedom, then maybe it's okay to be evil. Well, that would be fine if we had a conscience that told us it was okay to be evil. But our conscience does not tell us it's okay to be evil unless somebody is a complete psychopath or sociopath. And those are words that we came up with as a society because we recognize that the conscience is a real thing and a sociopath is somebody whose conscience is not working properly. That's like somebody being born without the ability to walk. We don't say that legs don't exist just because somebody might, unfortunately, have a birth defect and not be able to walk. Likewise, you can have a broken conscience. That doesn't mean there's no such thing as the conscience. And the very fact that we as a society came up with words like psychopath and sociopath to define a broken conscience shows this. Peter continues, divine hiddenness, especially in light of man's penchant for believing in God, as cosmic judge, jury, and executioner, also becomes a necessary condition, as the tyranny of ideas can be just as powerful and is arguably more powerful than physical oppression and enslavement. The Christian idea of the golden rule and the biblical record of the words of Jesus couple another idea to that golden rule that all people must love God as well. I know the idea I'm about to describe is a false dichotomy, but I consider the following question in my own mind. As a father, I think I have told you before, I have a son who is now a teenager. I asked myself, if I had to choose between two destinies for my son, which one would I choose? One destiny is that my son would have a happy, fulfilled life, but have no regard for his father. The other is that he would be a loving and dedicated son, but unhappy. Even though the idea of my son not caring for me is very painful to contemplate, it is still a no-brainer of a decision. I would choose his happiness over my own. Would not a good and loving God do at least as much? Well, Peter, you're assuming that they're mutually exclusive. Why do they need to be mutually exclusive? Can't we have a God who wants us to be happy and also wants us to love him? And if he created us in such a way that our conscience is going to resonate with what's true, and if it's true that we were created, then that would resonate with the idea of being thankful for our creation. Peter says, so in conclusion, perhaps God leaves us to our own devices. In my humble opinion, all assertions of divine inspiration and revelation aside, because that God values freedom above all else, and that freedom necessarily requires the possibility of evil, and that the overwhelming influence of the knowledge of God be hidden. Perhaps the forbidden fruit is not the knowledge of good and evil, but the knowledge of God himself. This is just the ruminations of one curious soul and is by no means an attempt to prove or advance any idea. I just thought I would share my morning's thoughts with you. Be well, Peter. Well, thank you for that, Peter. So let's go back over this. The golden rule argument for the existence of God says, if there's no God, there can be no good and evil. Human beings believe there's good and evil. Where did good and evil come from? Does that prove the existence of God? No, but it's impossible to have good and evil without some kind of God. Good and evil are not things. They're not substances in a test tube. Our conscience telling us good from evil is an interaction with our personality. The conscience itself is sentient. It's one of the best arguments for the existence of God. We'll see you next week. Enjoy kicking off the fifth season, the fifth year of the Bob Siegel Show. We'll be right back.
Thank you for listening to The Bob Siegel Show. The views and opinions are solely those of the host and guests and do not necessarily represent KCBQ or its sponsors. The Bob Siegel Show was brought to you in part by the Law Office of Thomas Pinkerton, helping infertile families have children. Tom Pinkerton would like to invite you to help Bob expand his radio program by donations or sponsorship. For more information about Bob's ministry, go to www.bobsiegel.net. Here, you can read Bob's articles and get information about Bob's books. That's Bob Siegel, SIEGEL.net.
Hello. When you invest your money in stocks, you invest in paper. With the Midas Gold Company, this will not happen to you because your investment is in the physical form of solid gold coins. The Midas Gold Company is now offering investment-grade pre-1933 gold coins that are non-confiscatable and non-reportable. Once you see and feel the proof of your invested money,